let me ask first. I realize the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, a number of years ago, bought into what's called ETA, Effectiveness Training Associates, out of Pasadena, in teaching the parent effectiveness training courses. Now, and that the American Lutheran Church is starting to buy into this package where pastors and teachers are being trained in a more positive means of communication and positive problem solving. How many of you have gone through, or let me ask that as the first question, how many of you have gone through one of these programs through your church, such as PET? Great, that's a good beginning. How many of you have read the book on PET?
A couple of
times. That's a good beginning. Okay. Some of the things that we'll be talking about today do come from PET, and I've found that this has been a very helpful part of our lives, and our household these past 5 or 6 years. As I look at the title and what I've written on the board, there are so many times we feel like saying, "Help! What do I do now?" Or who's, you know, we don't often say the next part of the title, of our title, of who owns the problem. We just say help, and most often as adults we feel that we're the ones that can solve the problem. After all, we're bigger, we're wiser, we're more knowledgeable, and we're in charge. So if it's a problem that deals with our children, and even if it's a problem that might deal with our spouse or with other adults with whom we have relationships, we still feel when anyone comes to us to say, "What should I do?" we have to be ready right then at a snap of a finger with instant answers. And it's part of our instant society that if we cannot answer the question right away, then maybe that means that we're not very capable. I want us to think about that for a while, that we have focused too much of our lives into a kind of speed orientation. We have to do things right away. We have to do them for everyone else. And sometimes it might be helpful if we stopped a moment to think, really, who owns the problem? Now, that's a very general statement, and there will always be exceptions to it, and I'll define some of these exceptions right away. If you have somebody who comes up and says, "Where's the bathroom?" you're obviously not going to say, "Gee, you really have to go pretty badly, don't you? You must have had too much tea last night." You know, that's not a time to stop and analyze the situation. There's a difference between asking for information, general basic information, and problem solving. So that's one of the first definitions that we want to make. Somebody says, "What time is dinner?" and it's here at Holden. You might say there's a setting at 12 o'clock and there's a setting at 1. That's lunch. Dinner would be at 5 and at 6. If you're in your household and one of your children at around 4 o'clock says, What time's dinner, Mom?" and you hadn't really decided, you might begin to think at that point, what is he really asking? You're hungry right now, or you can hardly wait until you're ready to eat, or and whoever it is, whether it's your spouse or a youngster, you might say, "No, I'm not hungry now, I've eaten, but I have to go off to such and such a meeting at 6:30, and I'm wondering if we can have supper before then." Sometimes there's more content to the question than we may know, and you say, "Oh, don't bother me now, I'm trying to get it ready as quickly as possible." You're not really going to solve, give much help to the question seeker, and you really won't know what kind of question that person is asking. So we want to look at the whole range of communication. And let me draw our famous window box. And into this, we look through this window. There's so much scratches on this board. I don't know if that black one would be easier to see than this.
This is fine.
Okay. we can look through our window of events that fall into what we might classify as problems, but we might also look at them as joys. Not everything that somebody comes to you is really a problem. Somebody may come in and say, wow, am I glad to be able to go out play ball this afternoon. And maybe it's been raining for the last 5 days, and you know they're looking forward to whatever the event, just when you were ready to say, hey, can you give me some help? So in a sense, it might be a problem for you, but it's really not a problem for the other person. They're looking forward to doing something else. So we can look at through our window, and we can draw a line. And we can say at the top that the other, I don't think I spell other, there are times that we look through our window of interactions and we discover in communication the other person owns the problem. Your spouse will come in and say, wow, I'm glad this day is over. What could be meant by that statement? What are some possibilities?
Hard day.
It was a hard day.
Hard day at Bedrock.
Hard day at Bedrock. What are the other possibilities?
Looking forward to
something else that's going to happen. What else might be the possibility?
He's had about all he can take.
He's had about all he can take.
He wants some sympathy or some understanding.
He needs some tender, loving care of some sort, understanding, whatever.
Help.
Pardon?
Help.
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 Okay, that traffic on the way home is more than I want to take again. Or I lost the contract. Or I just got fired. Or whatever. I had a whole pile of work to do and didn't get out a portion of it because so many people came knocking at the door or the telephone rang constantly or whatever. So, one statement. And you might respond, you think I've had a great day? Then what happens? You're pitting against each other. Going back to the first where he says, boy, am I glad today's over, or she says it. Who owns this particular problem?
Both.
He does. Mm-hmm.
At this particular time, the speaker does, whether it's the spouse, whoever. Maybe it's the youngster who comes at home and says this. That person is one who owns the problem. Something's happened to him. You're not involved in it yet. If you answer, you think I live in a bed of roses, you may both end up owning that problem. Mm-hmm. And then I can put down I. That I own the problem. But we don't have to get into this. We can just let it stay up here with the rightful owner of it. And depending upon how we help that person understand, or help that person deal with that problem, the simplest might be to accept that person for owning that problem. Gee, what can we say to him? What can we say to her?
Don't tell me about it.
That's a door opener. That would be a good way of beginning. Don't come home and tell me about your problems. Would you feel comfortable with that? Okay, we'll scratch that one. You ought to know better. Plan your day more constructively. Would that help you? Would that make you feel good?
No, don't.
Yeah, it's closing the barn door after the horse is stolen, and it doesn't do any good, does it? It just might rub you even worse. Whoever said life was going to be a bed of roses, would that help you? That's kind of sarcasm, and it doesn't really help very much, does it? You're really just saying that because you want some sympathy and you don't want to have to do anything around the house today, huh? Would that help you? It wouldn't?
Oh, you're always bellyaching.
Oh, that's a good one. How would that make you feel? I might even go right back out of the house again. Okay, what would make you feel better?
You mean if you're the one that's coming in with that feeling?
Okay, you're the one that's hearing the person saying it. What would you... okay, you're the person that made the statement. What would you hope the person that you're talking to might say to you that would make you feel good?
Come on in and sit down and tell me about your day.
Okay, that's a door opener. That's allowing them to say, okay, I realize days are going to be like this. Would you like to talk about it? Okay, that's another door opener.
Come on in and sit down. Let's have a cup of coffee and tell me about it.
Okay.
Sometimes.
How would that make you feel? How many people feel like that?
I think that's just a little bit too heavy. Like, you can maybe like you're feeling lousy or something, but not just come and sit down on my couch and unload.
You're saying you'd feel a little bit better if and maybe it'd be okay eventually to say, okay, let's have some coffee and sit down. But maybe you'd like something else before then, before the couch gets in hold.
You really are woofed.
You really are woofed. How would you feel about that? Okay?
Yeah, that's good.
Okay.
Little sympathy we have.
Okay, but how do you give them that little bit of sympathy? That's the kind, asking you to make a statement back to me. I'm the one that's as well.
Problem.
Pardon?
Acknowledge the problem.
Okay, give me an example.
The traffic was bad, was it?
No, it wasn't the traffic today that was lousy. That helped, but it was all these interruptions that went on when I, yeah. Or the person might have said, yeah, that is. One of these things, that's a good beginning feedback, because then it allows the other person to either verify it, say, yeah, that's what I mean, that's just what I'm complaining about, or to clarify it. No, that's not exactly what I meant, it was part of it, but boy, and then you might come out with what really happened, to help the other person understand a little bit more what's going on. So we have a couple of important words that come on with this. One is, there might be simpler ones, but because they sort of run, clarify and verify, I prefer to use this. Sometimes you return what you think you're hearing them say in a few other words. You're listening to what their feelings are, or you're trying to figure out what it is that you're giving back one of the interpretations that you have thought they might be meaning. That's one possibility of getting at it. Okay? What else? Somebody made the statement, you're really feeling woofed today. So that's a kind of feeling statement. The traffic was really bad today, huh? That's a kind of content statement. Either one of them kind of helping the other person to understand further what the speaker has as his problem. The problem still stays with the owner, the other person. Okay. So we're up in this top part where the other person owns the problem, and we have to accept them, that feelings are okay. Feelings aren't right or wrong. They're okay. And you can help the person to feel okay in owning these. It's okay to be tired at times. It's okay to be worn out, disappointed, upset, bothered, frightened, whatever. Once you can label what your feelings are and feel that it's okay to have these feelings, then you can constructively begin to deal with the feelings. And it's when you get to actions, it's actions that begin to have some kind of right or wrongs. If the person comes in with the feelings of, boy, I've had a lousy day, but then slams the door, kicks the dog, throws his briefcase or her briefcase at the spouse, that may be not quite so okay, right? You at least wouldn't want to be the door, the dog, or the person who gets hit by whatever flies. That's actions. And we have to look at, you know, that's another area. Usually if people's feelings are accepted, they don't get to the kinds of negative actions quite as often, unless they get some reinforcement from them. Okay, let's go on to the kind of I on the problem. I'll give an example of that. Our house for the last 6 years has been a no-smoking house. And it's nice to operate in a room that has the signs out around saying no smoking. My classrooms are no-smoking classrooms. And occasionally I'll get evaluations at the end of the term that says, prejudiced against smokers. Well, that's their problem, I think, at that, and their feelings of it. So I usually allow them a number of outs of where they can smoke. But in a sense, I own that problem. And at times when I said, okay, I'm not going to let it bother me, and I'll sit in a classroom or I'll sit in a building or a room where there's a lot of smoking going on, the next 2 or 3 days I have a very stuffy head and I sneeze and my eyes run and I feel very uncomfortable because it causes some physical problems for me. I own that. Now, whoever's smoking in the room is certainly going to be enjoying their smoking, or I hope they wouldn't be smoking. So it's not their problem at this particular time. So when I own the problem, I need to say something about my feelings. That I really get sinus problems when I'm in a smoky room, and I would appreciate it if for the while that we're working together, it could be a no-smoking room. If you really feel the need to smoke, you can go out into the next room or out onto the porch or wherever the situation might be. Now, I can make a statement of my feelings to the other person and allow the other person then to respond as to whether they can really put up without a cigarette, whether it's bothersome or not. So at this time, the other person doesn't own the problem. If the other person, however, happens to be a chronic or a constant chain smoker, we may get into the area where we both own the problem, and there may be some overlapping where we would deal with it in a different sense. When I own the problem, however, I have to be brave enough to say how I feel, rather than, you stupid, inconsiderate slob, why don't you ever put that adult pacifier into the ashtray? How would you feel about that if you were the smoker?
Insulted.
Yeah, I wouldn't feel so good about it either. You know, that wouldn't help the problem at all, would it? That puts the problem onto you, and I stay clean. I own the problem. I have to be brave enough to admit that this is really how I feel about it. I really, another kind of situation, households. When you've got a number of people going in and out, our family reads the paper on the floor, not sitting in chairs. Everyone does. It's strange to see the paper on the couch. It's usually in the middle of the floor. Hopefully, when the person gets through reading it, it gets put on a table somewhere. Not all the time does it get on the table. And it may not bother the reader. Maybe they were planning to come back and read it again. But in the meantime, somebody's coming in, and here's 9 sheets of paper lying all over the floor. That's my problem. I don't like to see the paper left on the floor when nobody's around reading it. It gets stepped on, the dog comes and runs around in circles and squinches the paper all up, and you don't have anything decent to read. So I can give a statement of what my feelings are. And in the process, allow whoever else is involved to take some of their own responsibility and put it into practice by saying, oh, I forgot, or yes, I'll go and get it, or I'm not finished reading it, I'm coming right back as soon as I pick up something. If they say, I don't have enough time to do it, you're in this middle area, both of you only have a problem. But until that happens, it's really your problem. It's really my problem, excuse me. And if I were to say, you get in there right this instant and put that paper away, how would you feel if you were the person talked to in this matter?
Rebellious.
Rebellious? Sometimes these kinds of demands, particularly depending upon the tone that they're given in, does invite rebellion. It invites a challenge. And why that happens to be more the nature now of people than it was, say, when we were growing up 20 years, 30 years ago, I don't know, but that's the changes in society, too. So many of the ways that we were helped to grow up toward responsibility aren't necessarily working that well, the commands, the demands that were given.
So you say it's our problem when the house is messy, it doesn't bother somebody else, it bothers me, then I have to pick it up.
No, that doesn't mean that you have to pick it up. It may be your problem indeed, because you are more concerned about keeping it clean, or that you have a different standard. It doesn't bother the kids or your spouse maybe to see the papers on the floor. It would bother me, particularly when I know our dog likes to run around in circles on top of papers. She doesn't use them, but she just likes the noise, and it moves all around, and that's a game for her. It means then that hopefully, it's certainly not going to happen the first time you do it, because we've lived in such a different kind of system, that people can begin, we can help others begin to accept and understand feelings of all people involved, and that there's always a responsibility to other people. So that there are certain rules, that there's certain information that they may have responsibility toward, and that is, papers get picked up when you're finished using them, a kind of rule. We went on an overnight with the teenagers on Tuesday, Wednesday, up to Donkey Lake. And it was interesting to see that every one of the kids that was up there, all the people that were involved, because we packed in, had a down sleeping bag. Well, down sleeping bags need a little bit better care than some of the old, hard, sturdy, waterproof plastic kind of ones. So knowing that kids like to play pranks on each other, practical jokes, we made two basic rules in camp. One was that there was to be no water, particularly for going to bed at night. There was to be, and it was cool, it was pleasant, but it was cool. There was to be no water in the sleeping area, particularly on the sleeping bags. Because I could see some of them thinking, oh, I'll carry so-and-so down to the lake and dump them in their sleeping bag. And then that person has a wet bag to sleep in the rest of the night, and it's going to be cold. And that to have concern for other people's property. You know, don't think it's funny when you get somebody else's t-shirt or a sweatshirt wet that they're going to have to sleep in, or whatever. So these two basic rules, a concern for other people and concern for other people's property. The kids were waking up for breakfast in the morning, and they were on the edge of a flat area. It was above where we were eating, and they were at a flat area, and then there was a nice slope that went quite a distance down to the lake. All of a sudden, I looked up, and there were two kids pulling a zipped-together sleeping bag, so it was two sleeping bags, with one kid inside, down this hill, which made me see red as well as the green of the sleeping bag. And my statement was, sleeping bags are not for sliding downhill. That was a basic, I don't feel happy about you. That was not just my feelings, it was a basic rule that they all knew. So that people, this is not saying you don't have certain rules in your house, but you can just remind them of what the rule is rather than saying, you do such and such. The kids stopped right in their tracks, got out of the sleeping bag, picked it up and carried it up and dusted it off. Now that's helping them to realize their own responsibility by their own experiences. I'm sure it might have been a different reaction if I would have said, "You stupid louts, what are you doing? You know that that's the rule," and so forth and so forth. And the cleaning bag might have been left there, and I'll keep going.
What I hear you saying then is not to personalize every command, because that's either going to be insulting or demanding, mm-hmm. personally. I heard a mother just 2 days ago say, "I called my daughter and I said, Jody, I need help." And that sort of goes along with this. But if I had, and she came right up and said, "What is it, Mom?" She said, "If I had called down and said, Jody, would you please come up and make these beds?" She just said, "I made them yesterday, it's Kim's turn." It would have been a whole big argument. And then that just, I hear that in our family, you know, why doesn't he do what I did it before? Mm-hmm. If you appeal to them sort of on a standard, it helps.
Mm-hmm. And you're the one at this point that owns the problem, because you can't stand seeing the beds made. The kids don't matter. It doesn't bother them. I need help. It's a kind of I message, and this is what in PET would be called the I message. What we were doing up here when we were trying to feed back the other person's feelings or what we're hearing them say, so we can get a verification or a clarification on it, is what's called a feedback message. It generally begins with a you. It doesn't have to. It could begin with anything else. Sometimes we're tempted to say in this, "You do such and such," and that's what's called an ineffective kind of view that's in the wrong place. We want to get into an area of problem solving here. How we begin to deal with listening to when the other person owns the problem and helping them. Most often you don't want somebody to give you a pat answer, because not everybody's answer is going to fit you. It may fit them. And the way you respond to either one of these depends very much upon the situation. It depends upon how you feel. It depends upon what else is going on in the day. And sometimes, just about anything is going to cause a problem to me. I'm tired. I've pressed for time. I've got 900 things to do and 2 minutes to do them in, and everybody else seems to be sitting around and nobody else responding and so forth. And in that kind, maybe I'm way up here and, you know, there's only a little bit of space for somebody else. Sometimes the days might be very good for me. And I'll look at the beds, they're not made. Oh, so what? Okay. They're going to have to sleep in them. Why should I worry about it? Papers on the floor, and I'll say, "I've read it already. They haven't, and the dog gets it all torn up. That's their problem." And I might not, I'll let a lot of things be in the other arena. We need a section in here where we can work together on it. But in the last year or so, Tom Gordon, who is the author of Parent Effectiveness Training, has come out with a book called Teacher Effectiveness Training that's used in the school. They've used this particular one for both school programs to teach teachers and administrators in a more positive communication method. And they also used it for executive training in businesses and corporations. They now have a special one out for teachers. The only difference is that the examples are related to the school situation and not necessarily to the home between parent and child. They haven't gotten one out, as far as I know yet, for the executives. But the teacher one makes a very important point that in a situation where any kind of learning is going on, learning can only occur in this area where no problems exist. So if we have in the household or in the church or in the school, if either I, as the teacher, I'm bothered by a lot of things, I'm not going to be very effective in getting across the things that I think are going to be important to get across. If the other person is bothered, they're hungry, and many people wonder, why do we have breakfast programs in the school? Good heavens, can't families provide it? Well, sometimes some families don't think it's important, sometimes they don't have the means, sometimes whatever. Whatever the reason is that the kid comes off to school without breakfast and is in need of it, and is hungry, they're owning that particular problem of not being ready to put attention into something that may not seem very relevant in their life at the time, and they're not going to be able to learn very well. Or if they're bothered, they're afraid of, you know, they really, the roof has been lowered on them, that they've been in real trouble, whatever it is, outside the home, within the home. The parents are angry at them. The parents are angry at each other, and the child is afraid of what's going to happen. They're going to be very concerned about what's going on at home or how they're going to relate to it. And they're not going to think very much about the sermon that's going to be presented in church or the lesson in Sunday school or the youth group or the lesson in the schoolroom or wherever it is. They're going to be concerned with what's bothering them at the time. And this is where it's very important, I think, for people in whatever the helping profession is, from nursing to education to religious organizations, wherever, to be tuned in to how we can accept other people with their problems and allow them to find ways to work through them rather than saying, now this is what you've got to do, and it may not work. The first time I was involved in a listening workshop was through a pastoral counseling center that we have in Syracuse. And my husband was involved in the pastoral program. And at that point in the beginning, they set up 6-session series for lay people from the congregations whose pastors were involved in the training program to come to be supportive of the pastor in the work that was being done in the congregation. And we had about 10 people from our campus congregation who went. Then they stopped this particular lay program and they said, well, you invite us out to the churches and we'll come, rather than people coming into the center. And this since our congregation is very small, we never were really able to afford the kind of package, so we haven't done it. But we realized a great difference during the several years in the whole community of our congregation, having these 10 people in it who were really sensitive and listening to other people and helping them to identify feelings and such, that has never really happened since all these people left. So that we could begin to do things constructively in this kind of no problem area. And it's really very helpful. But let's go into this section now where we both own the problem. I said a couple of times over again, get those papers up off the floor, or it's time to get the dishes off the table, or whatever. We can come at it in a variety of cutesy means and do some manipulating and say, when you do this, then if you do this, then we can have a special treat, a kind of bribe. Sometimes that works, and sometimes it works all too well, and the only way you can get them to do something is if you've got a little bait dangling at the other end, whatever it may be, adult privileges or children's privileges. And that teaches some bad habits. How can we get at problem solving? Let's throw out a problem that you think, that anyone thinks that we can work together on, that might be a fairly common problem of what, in the church or in households, between children and parents, or between spouses, between people who work together. Let's see how we can do some problem solving on it. Idea.
One is a proper diet for children. We have a child who's completely negative on eating anything proper. He's great on bread and honey, and that's it.
Oh, and you see that honey pot on the table and all that good bread, and that seems to satisfy him, doesn't it? Okay, should we work on this? How many of you have this kind of problem? Would this be something
we... teenagers that live on potato chips and Cokes.
Okay. Okay. It's, in a sense, it's a problem for the... First of all, the owner is the parent who's bothered by the poor nutritional habits. And you know that these are growing years. You know that they need to have vitamins and minerals, etc., in order to grow properly and for cells to develop properly, and etc. It's not bothering the kids. They like the potato chips and Coke, or they like this great homemade bread and honey. And after all, isn't homemade bread good and nutritious and honey? So it's not a problem to them. When does it become a problem for both of you?
When the child ends up in the hospital with rickets or whatever.
Okay, that's certainly... Yeah, or they go so long that their system is weakened, and since there's some creeping crud going around the village right now with at least some of the faculty kids, that people are getting exposed to. I mean, they're having some colds and such. And some of these changes in temperatures where it gets fairly cool at night and hot in the daytime.
Doesn't it become your problem as soon as feels responsible for that child's diet, it becomes a problem, not when he ends up in the hospital?
Okay, so you're saying it's even a little bit sooner than that. The problem is at the dinner table, and you've given some I feel kinds of, or I think it's important, or these are great, and general statements. Or kind of feeling statements, and there's still no response. And you go a little further, and then the child becomes pushed, and then it does become the child's problem. And it becomes both of your, the child becomes involved in it as well, because there's a kind of resistance. They've got to keep up their sense of self-control, their sense of self-decision-making if they're old enough to begin to feel some means of independence. I don't really need it, and such. And okay, there was a hand over here.
So what happens if you have honey in the house, or jam, or peanut butter?
You're thinking of it here at Holden, where the peanut butter and the
yeah,
honey is on.
I never realized it before when I was Holden, but I can't see why when we, especially our supper meal, is just, if you want to just everything's there. Why do people have to have bread with peanut butter and honey
splattered
all over it? Like, it shouldn't be on the table.
Okay.
Yes. It's a peanut butter and honey, and that's whole wheat bread, whatever it is. Your personal portion of the chapter.
Okay, there's a teenager speaking now. There's one of these children who says, but peanut butter is nutritious and the bread is nutritious, etc.
It is.
Okay. There are a number of people on the staff, and I think a few of the guests too, who are attempting to be as vegetarian as they can be. And then the peanut butter, I don't know about the honey, except sometimes you put honey on top of peanut butter. Peanut butter does have a lot of protein. It's missing some of these vitamins and such that you can get only in vegetables.
What about I don't like? I don't like.
Oh, the I don't like, which comes in there, as you say, you need, it's important to eat a balanced diet, but I don't like.
Back to this question about what about why is the bread there available at the supper? I think it probably stems back to the traditional background. I grew up in the Midwest, and in my particular family, we did have homemade bread a lot, but both my parents had come from places where the bread was a staple regardless of what meal. They always had bread and butter on the table, even for the supper meal. So when we first got married, my husband coming from a different tradition and growing up out here in San Francisco, I don't know if that may make any difference in someone else's background, but he said for the sake of the fact that relatives throughout had problems with weight, let's stop bread at evening meal continually and never have bread at evening meal except once in a while, dinner rolls or something as a
when the special company comes in who likes the bread.
Right. But not as a staple whatsoever.
And so you did some problem solving on this.
We just stopped it, and for my benefit, it was better also.
So that may be one of the reasons why they serve it here, because they realize a lot of people who come in are accustomed to having it for evening meals. Some comment here.
Well, I was just going to relate to the teenagers. I have an 11 and a 13-year-old boy. And I don't think teenagers can identify with vitamins and what's good for you, because my grandmother ate mush oatmeal in the morning, you know, that they should. So I just tried to word picture things that they can identify with. Okay, you have a bike, you know, or something that you want, an animal that you want to take care of, and you give him some oil or whatever for his coat to make it shiny and all this. Okay, you've got all these foods, and you're going to have to feed all the parts of you. You know, mm-hmm. carrots for your eyes and protein for your muscles, which comes from meat, and vitamins for... And I just, when they eat an excess of sweets, I'll say, boy, you know, you're going to be able to swim the English Channel and not even feel the cold. You're going to be so fat, you know, all those fat muscles are just going to keep you protected. But your brain is starving, your eyes aren't getting any carrots and vitamin A. You know what I said?
Does it work?
It has helped.
Okay.
For one reason is that the 13-year-old wants it to turn out for football, and he's like a little pencil. I mean, he's just going to smack if somebody hits him, you know. And all of a sudden, he's relating all these things to him, making him have a goal. He has a goal now. Before that, he could eat chocolate milk shakes and hamburgers. And
that'll give him the fat to get him out of the string bean position.
So I think identifying it with something personal for them might help.
Okay. Let's see if we can do some problem solving. We've got a couple of ideas of what's worked in a couple of situations and some background as to why some of these things may be happening. Let's define the problem. It's an eating problem that's not very broad and very nutritious. Would that be how we would describe the problem? Okay. In the whole problem-solving process that comes through the particular communication system of PET, the first step is to define the problem so the people who are working on the problem know what they're trying to work together on. Maybe I'm going to think it's how to get them away from peanut butter and honey, and somebody else is thinking, but I want I don't want them to get too fat. It may be a diet control, and somebody else might be thinking of something else, and you're going to be solving different problems. So you need to be sure that the problem you're going to work on is the same one. The second step is just brainstorm all possibilities without evaluating them. Once you start to evaluate some solutions, then you get bogged down, and it detracts from maybe some of them are really far out and ridiculous. But instead of putting them down and saying, oh, that's stupid, I wouldn't absolutely allow that, maybe they realize that you wouldn't, but you can build from that one onto something else that might come up into a fairly favorable working solution. So let's brainstorm and just give out different ideas of how one might solve a particular problem, such as, now this can be a very quick kind of process, or it can be a very long drawn out one, depending upon what the problem is. And it may be just simpler to sit down and say, you eat. You're not leaving this table until everything on that plate is finished. Final. And you might be there for a long, long time. Or the kid might really say, oh, what's the use fighting? And might eat it, have an upset stomach, and throw up later. I don't know, that's an exchange. How can you help in the whole process of saying, okay, how can we solve this? You know, or whatever. So that when people, whoever you're working with, get into other situations, problems with other people where they both own the problem, they can have a kind of system to work on rather than use power and might as being the decision maker. And when final answers are handed down from on high, it's never really as satisfactory as if you've had a hand in helping to solve something that's your own problem. Okay. Let's get out some ideas of what might be possibilities. Just quick thought. Just speak about.
Oh, well, just that I don't see the problem two ways. I would put it, I have a problem in that I wish to be a good mother to you, and I don't see you eating right, so I don't feel like a good mother. How could you make me, you know, solve my problem?
So you're asking, okay, you're giving one statement and asking them to help. Okay, that's one possibility. Another one.
I need to bring that child eating the best possible bread to get.
food and supply.
Okay, so if you're going to, okay, desk bread. Okay, anyone else?
How about if you said something like, you may have the thing that you like after you've eaten this other thing that you don't like.
When you finish something, then.
Okay, that's cool.
Which is a very, it's better to use the when then, rather than if you, then you.
I was thinking along that same line, you could say, well, now, maybe at lunchtime, you can have all the bread and honey you want, but at supper time.
You know, all hungry. Okay. Bread, lunch, supper.
What's on?
Okay.
We had a certain portion. For instance, for peas that our son did not care for at a particular stage in his growth. That he must have a small amount, just a small amount to taste each time. It didn't have to be a portion, a regular portion at all, but a spoonful, just so that each time that we had it, that he'd have a taste of it. And he did develop a taste for it, and later on it worked fine. It sometimes works and it sometimes doesn't.
I remember one of our students who was from a family of nine said it was a rule in their family that you had to have one of everything depending upon your age. If you were five, you had five teams. If you were seven, she said, by the time you got to be 12, forget it. It was put on and you don't count. Okay, kind of portion control. Other ideas?
Well, you might say to them, you really don't like asparagus, don't you? Is there some other vegetable you'd rather have instead?
Okay, options then, a line.
But also in that, I wanted to indicate the fact that you do recognize that there are some things that a person just plain really doesn't like. Other things they might just not like just because they don't want to have it pushed at.
It's a very good way of putting that statement. Understanding what their feeling is and then working through that particular smaller part of the problem. Okay, vegetables are important and you don't like asparagus.
So let's have broccoli.
What are some of the other possibilities? Yeah, okay.
Another thing, I had two boys that were good eaters, and then along came a finicky little girl. And I was used to dishing up, and they always cleaned it up. And so my husband said, if you would let her dish it up, you know, she may take two peas, like you say. She had to take some, but she could dish it up, and then she ate. She had to eat because she dished it up. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, it helped them a little bit. Yeah.
I gave her the responsibility.
Yeah.
Okay, let me put that down as a separate one. Give a kind of responsibility to the child. Okay. Within a kind of decided framework. And you can work. Okay, I'm not evaluating. Further ideas.
I think we have to look at the problem honestly and see the child's diet and the daily diet rather than meal by meal, and then maybe it'll be in proportion.
Okay, if they don't,
you might get all the fruit for and one meal and don't need it again the rest of the day. You could eat like that.
Maybe they prefer to eat their carrots and some vegetables as snacks in the middle of the afternoon.
So that especially for small children.
Okay, whole day needs. Others.
I think another idea is just not to have certain snack foods around that you know aren't healthy. You know, why tempt the child by having these things constantly around if you don't want them to eat them?
Don't really eat them in somebody else's house, though.
But then I'll be able to just toss that off. Well, we're just putting down the statement. Don't stock junk. I'm sorry, I didn't get the first one down, and now I've forgotten it. What was the very first one we said?
I have a problem, you know.
First of all, the mother had a problem.
Okay.
I want to be a good mother.
Okay, the mother personalizes the problem. Okay.
My solution to that is she goes to the grocery store with me and she can pick out, she gets a 6-pack of Coke a week. She gets 2 treats. She can pick out, and then she has to make that last week.
Okay. child rations, own junk food.
Chowder, own junk food, and then rations.
Okay, any others? Yes.
Parents have to examine our own things because it's so easy for us to say you have to eat this ration and then the kids are in bed we can throw them out for Sunday.
And they can see right through us.
There's nothing wrong with a hot cook Sunday.
No,
we've eaten all our goodies for the day.
Yeah, I picked that up.
Yeah. Examine your own habits.
Yeah.
Some of your family can't stand certain vegetables, but you're telling your kids you have to eat them. Wow, you're headed for failure. Okay?
I think one of our motives should be that children would learn about good food. And so I think, you know, if just so they get fresh fruit and vegetable and protein during the day or whatever they need. And one other little thing I think is that the timing of meals is so important. And if they really are hungry, maybe some way either give them a healthy snack early so it doesn't interfere with meals. But if they're truly hungry, I don't think there's going to be as much of a problem either.
Okay, the whole timing is very important. Sometimes they can't last as long as adults can. Okay, the next step in problem solving is that we've gotten out a really quite a lot of good ideas. When I first went through this, we dealt with the problem of kids making beds. And I ended up solving a lot of our problems of our two daughters making their beds, going back to a practice that my mother had used, and I had completely forgotten, where the blankets are encased in a cover. It's like a big pillowcase. That the top part is your spread, and the bottom part is a kind of sheet, and so you take it off once a week, once every 2 weeks, and wash it. And so when they get out of bed, all they have is this one big thing to pull up. And we solved a lot of the hassles of pulling up three blankets, a sheet, several blankets, and a bedspread on top, which they never got properly done anyway. Identifying, clarifying what the problem is the first step. Second is get out all the possibilities, some of the far-fetched ones. We've had some very good ones here, I think. The third step, then, is for the people who own the problem, and this is something you're going to have to go back and do with your own kids, decide which ones are acceptable to both of you. Which ones might you try? Which ones would be worthwhile trying? And the fourth step is to decide, okay, how do you put it into practice? Should we try this and how long? Should we try this for 2 weeks and see how this works? How should we go through it? A chance to come back and evaluate it, this last one, and then find out, really, does it really work? Don't feel that once the solution is solved for it temporarily, it's going to be solved for all time, because situations change, feelings change, the context, what you can do at home and what you can do at Holden Village are two very different things. So we won't go through the next final step of this. This is something you're each going to have to do. A very important part, which a lot of people forget as they read PET, is that there is a section toward the end that lists, that talks about the non-negotiables. Many parents say, but I can't do this problem solving. There are some given things that I just won't allow to happen in my household, to my spouse, to my relationships, and my children. Yes, there will always be some of these. And then you put these down. You discuss them perhaps as some household rules, or you state them that I feel very strongly that this is important. But pick and choose your battleground. You can't make the whole waterfront non-negotiable. And then expect when your children get to be 12 or 14 or 16 that they're going to know how to make problems and make decisions all themselves when they've never been involved in the problem-solving process. You need practice in this just like you do multiplication tables. And you start in one grade and you continue all the way through. Once you go through a problem-solving process, doesn't mean it's learned now and forever. It's a continual reminder kind of thing. And you practice it. When you have opportunities to try it out and to work through where you can solve things and say, gee, you know, I feel good about this. I didn't even think of some of the ideas that you raised, and I think they're going to work well, where you can describe and give some praise to the situation that's happening, not to, boy, you're such a good kid, you'll agree to do anything. That's going to make it sure failure. Anyone want to stay around for second session? We have conversation time in here.